This is Dr. Allie Evans welcoming you to Light on Health, a show where we shine the light on a full spectrum of topics that affect your health and that of our entire community. My guest today is Dr. Jennifer McCall. She's a pediatrician at Columbia Memorial Hospital for just a short while longer, and she is relocating to Santa Rosa, but we'll beg her back, at least to visit. So Jennifer, Dr. McCall and I are going to be talking about pediatric health and some updates and what's changed in the field and some common concerns that we as parents and caregivers might have for our kids. So thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about how you got interested in pediatrics and how you ended up kind of here in Astoria seeing all these kids.
Well, I when I was doing medical school and shadowing after doctors, I found, and also I did an osteopathic internship. And during that time, I found the only time I wasn't upset when I got woken up in the middle of the night was if it was for a child. So I kind of figured I should go into pediatrics, and I'm really happy I stayed with it. And after residency, I was looking for jobs, and I wanted a place where I felt like I could make an impact, and I wanted a smaller community. And this at the same time, Columbia Memorial was opening up the pediatric office, and I was really excited that the office was new, and so I could be able to help create a clinic.
And that was how many years ago?
It was 7 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now you, how long do you have left at this clinic before you go?
So my last day is on the 7th of August, and I'll be starting, working in Santa Rosa. Yeah.
So we're going to squeeze out everything from your brain before you leave, and you can leave your last final words with our community. So since you've been in the field of pediatrics, what do you think has shifted a lot? Have you seen, I think in health we see these like, you know, it's not static. It's this evolution and health changes and, conditions change and treatments change. What have you noticed the most that has changed in the field?
I think for me, what I've noticed a lot more is the emphasis on preventative care and also especially diet with the pediatric population. For me, I think that's changed the most within the whole pediatric community.
Do you think the recommendations have changed? Do you think the awareness has changed? Do you think the foods have changed? Is it kind of all of it?
Yeah, I think all of it. There are a couple of new recommendations out that just the AAP has just recently supported. Only six teaspoons or 30 grams of added sugar per day and one sweetened beverage a week.
Wow. And that is drastically different than what most kids are having and adults.
Yes, that includes juice, because a lot of parents are under the misconception that juice is very healthy for you. But
wait, it's not a food group?
Yeah, it's not a food group. It's better if you want grape juice, it's better to eat your grapes.
Wow. So added sugar means not naturally included in the food. It doesn't.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. So you have to be careful about your Go-Gurts. Those are very high in sugar and granola.
Yeah, what
bars.
Do you think? How many Go-Gurts do you think would be that recommendation, would be the 6 teaspoons of sugar?
So I would imagine a yogurt has almost 30 grams of sugar.
So basically the recommendation is, aside from naturally occurring sugars in a whole foods diet, you could have one yogurt a day and nothing more.
Exactly. You have to choose it. I mean, the other day I was putting honey on my toast, and so I Googled how many grams of sugar was in a teaspoon of honey, and it was like 16 or 17, and I said, well, that's half of my allotted amount of, so I haven't been adding any honey to my to my toast anymore.
You're gonna think twice about that.
Yeah, I have to think twice. Yes.
Do you think that this came from childhood obesity and juvenile diabetes, or do you think this came from just a real look at the food system and what's happening?
I think both.
Yeah.
I think both. And, you know, there's been that big expose that came out about how the sugar industry really covered up, you know, how bad the effects of sugar are and tried to put it onto fat. So that recently came out just a few weeks ago as well. So I think there's, we have an increasing problem with obesity in the nation, and I think so people are looking at that, and within that, you know, I think just an awareness of what we're eating.
Yeah, and I know in my practice I have a lot of kids that have just recurring, which I'm sure you do too, recurring ear infections.
Yes.
the kids that basically just have the runny nose and it never goes away.
Yes.
Maybe it goes away for like a month in the summertime. Mm-hmm. And so I think we see also these elements of a depressed immune system. And sugar has been found
yes.
time and time again in the research to depress mm-hmm. the immune system.
Exactly.
So it's kind of that double whammy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
And do you think diet-wise, are there other guidelines that have kind of shifted for kids?
I think for a lot of parents out there, they're used to the food pyramid,
yeah.
which didn't make a lot of sense. So now, you know, the food pyramid has been thrown away and it's going by plates of food, you know. And so if you look at a plate of food, you know, you want half of it to be fruits and vegetables, with vegetables being slightly more than your fruit. And then a quarter of your plate protein and a quarter carbs and a glass of milk for your dairy. So nowhere on there is there sugar.
Right. Right. And what do you tell your patients' parents about getting vegetables into kids? You know, I know yeah. I have this conversation all the time. Kids have such particular, you know, mm-hmm. their taste buds are growing and they're kind of learning to discern.
Right.
But there's sort of two schools of thought. One is like hide the vegetables anywhere you can, just puree mm-hmm. them in things, mm-hmm. put them in muffins. Mm-hmm. And then the other school is like, no, keep putting it on that plate over and over and over until they learn that this is.
I think you have to do both.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sneak it in and overtly put it there.
And studies show if you have your own garden,
That's right.
Kids will eat their own. They'll go and they'll eat carrots that they've never wanted to eat before, or broccoli, because it's in the garden. So that's when I was a resident, we did one of my fellow residents and I did. We started a camp called Operation Fit. And when it is for the as for obese patients who are from a lower economic community. And it was amazing teaching them about diet. I mean, these parents and kids had no idea what was good and what was bad. But you took them in, and they would tell you, I don't like vegetables. But we took them to a garden, and they picked their own vegetables, and they cooked them, and they ate them.
Isn't that, it's yes. so true. It's sort of that idea of, like, telling someone what to do and having them learn that on their
exactly.
own or experience it on their own.
And maybe getting kids in the kitchen, helping them prepare meals.
Right.
Having them be part of, well, what are we going to have for dinner? Okay, let's decide together.
Right. Mm-hmm. I know I remember when my kids were really young, we'd go into the co-op and I'd say, like, you can pick any vegetable and I'll make it. And sometimes I'd end up with these, like, I remember one time it was like the Buddha hand citrus.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, oh,
that is such a great idea. I love that idea.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. then it's this this mm-hmm. exploration and this mm-hmm. excitement.
That's
and
great.
I know around here, too, even with the farmers that have CSAs,
yes.
my kids like to just go pick up our box and see what's inside the box.
It is exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't mean they'll always eat
exactly.
it, but they like to look at
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Do you, and tell me with, we've talked a little bit about diet. Mm-hmm. What do you think has changed, not so much in the field, but more with kids' health? What do you kind of see as an ongoing trend and what seems to be changing with their health?
Well, I definitely see kids getting heavier and heavier.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are many, many things that contribute to it. I do think it's sugary beverages. I think that there is a lot of intake of processed foods. Granola bars people think are really healthy, or fruit snacks, which are just sugar. But the other thing, too, is I feel like we don't really wait for meals enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kids come home from school, they snack, and when dinner comes, they're not hungry for dinner because they've been snacking since they've gotten home or on the weekends. So I think, you know, getting back to 3 meals a day, maybe a couple snacks, which are fruits or vegetables, and then, you know, because I think if you're hungry, you should snack on a fruit or a vegetable and stop packaged foods.
Right.
So kids are heavier and they're less active.
Right.
They're a lot more sedentary, sitting in front of
electronics.
Electronics.
Yeah.
And you don't see that many kids out playing outside after school. You know that there are kids in the community, but you don't really see them outside.
That's right. That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Our culture's kind of mm-hmm. gone. We've become kind of hibernating because mm-hmm. of electronics, I think. It's
right.
the way that we all know and kids all know how to decompress after a long day at school.
But I wonder how much of it, too, is, you know, we feel like we have to accompany our kids to the park or
yes.
something like that, too. You know, it's
yes.
like, well, I can't take you to the park because I'm doing it. But I remember going to the park, and I'm not saying that that's the right thing, you know, but it's just, yeah.
One of my patients told me this statistic. So, you know, there's all this concern in our society, and rightfully so, to a certain degree, about leaving our kids unattended. And a patient of mine was reading a book called Free Range Children. And it said, if you wanted to get your child abducted, like if you were trying to, you'd have to leave them on a street corner for like 13,262 years. Like that's kind of what it measures up to. Of course, if it's your child, it's 100%.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
it doesn't matter. It's a but it's just kind of that, you know, we do, we are, we live in fear. And some of it is very rightfully so, but it does make you, you know, if you have something to do as a parent.
And I think parents are busier too. You know, I you know, parents are, especially here in this community with the way the schools are, you know, there's one grade school in the area and then, you know, but I remember walking to school. My memories of my childhood are walking to and from school. And, you know, parents now have to shuttle their kids to and from school because of maybe distance and also time. They have to get to work. You know, they don't have the luxury of...
And I think this speaks to much larger, you know, as we're talking about how has kids' health changed, our society just continues to speed up.
Exactly.
So it's like our kids, when we look at their health, their biology and physiology has to speed up with it. So I think even this idea, you know, about obesity, such a portion is not moving your body and what you eat. And some of it is just the stress hormones that keep us in this fight or flight kind of running. And when you have parents running around like crazy, getting kid from activity to activity, they're, it's sort of like their physiology also wants to retain fats and keep them running from a tiger.
The cortisol. I also think too, as when you become inactive, you know, it creates a cascade of different things that are produced in the body. But the body is meant to move. It is meant to be worked out. And so you start having aches and pains when, if you were active, you probably wouldn't be having those same types of...
Do you see this? Do you see kids having kind of musculoskeletal pain that's different
back
from
pain,
just
yes,
you do?
Yeah,
but different from the growing pains?
Yes. I think it is from inactivity.
And do you think growing pains are actually from bones growing?
I think it's probably, more from, yes, I do think it is from bones growing, but also the activity on the bones. So the bones are a little sensitive.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But I'm no expert on that.
Yeah. Well, it's what I like to tell my kids. And do you find, what do you think is going on with, you know, the increasing allergies in kids. We have, you know, we have this sedentary life, we have obesity. What do you think is going on with all these allergies?
Yeah, I wonder if it's because, you know, if you go, you know, they have that, the hygiene hypothesis, you know, in third world countries where you don't have as many allergies. And the thought is behind that, the body is exposed to natural, you know, dust and dirt, and the body's fighting that. But I wonder how much of it is that in our society, we are exposed to a lot of chemicals and things that are unnatural that you don't get in third world nations. You know, soap, sanitizers, carpet cleaners, you know, all these things that are not natural.
Even just like fragrances. I look at the fragrances in what girls are putting on, you know, and all these fragrances have estrogens in it and have, you know, xenoestrogens, the kind that mimic it. And they have all these chemicals that kind of clog up the body.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if that, I mean, I think probably there is some of that hygiene hypothesis, but I wonder how much of it is just exposure to synthetic products.
Yeah. And then on top of it, we've got, you know, 75% of our immune system in our GI tract. And like we talked about with diet and depleted food sources and processed food, it doesn't give a lot of, a lot of the raw nutrients and the raw ingredients our immune systems need.
Right.
Yeah. We kind of joke about it that like it's going to become, it's peanut free schools now. And then it's going to be, you know, it's going to pretty soon be like egg free, gluten free, dairy free. And kids are going to come in with a head of broccoli, which might not be so bad.
Yeah. Well, you know, some new recommendations for infants that between 6 and 9 months that we are to, before in the past we'd say don't give peanut butter, don't give eggs until about 2, but now the recommendation is between that 6 and 9 months of age that you expose kids in small and increasing amounts to all of those, so peanut butter, eggs, yogurt, all, if you're eating it, you should expose your child so that their gut gets accustomed to eating that.
Yes. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it keeps flip-flopping. It keeps, like, I remember in med school, it was really the longer you let the gut develop and then introduce, and then it flip-flops.
Exactly. I think maybe we're looking at different cultures, you know, like if you, like my mother's Korean. You know, and so I grew up eating a lot of Korean food that she actually would chew in her mouth beforehand, which I know Alicia Silverstone got flack from a few years ago. Yeah, but you know, they're finding that you know, the natural enzymes in your mouth may be helpful. And it's speaking about
and the good bacteria.
Yes, the good bacteria. Yeah. Yes, and I don't know. Have you seen? Michael Pollan's Cooked.
Yes.
And he's talking about the fermentation of foods and the fermentation of bread and about how, you know, gluten, you know, we're having increasing problems with it. But also, if you look at all the stuff we add in bread, you know, but before in the past, it was wheat, water, and salt, and it was allowed to ferment. And so, you know, all those natural minerals and vitamins were released. And now we add yeast to speed up the process of making bread, and we lose that.
Right. And we add all sorts of let's change the color, let's make it last 3 weeks
on
the
shelf. Yeah, let's add our own vitamins and minerals to it instead. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a quick break. We're talking with Dr. Jennifer McCall about pediatric health. I'm Dr. Allie Evans, and this is Light on Health. This is Light on Health on Coast Community Radio. I'm talking with Dr. Jennifer McCall about pediatric health and what's happening with our kids in our community. So let's do a little rapid fire Q&A and let's talk about a few conditions.
I'll try.
We'll see. Yeah, we'll see how you hold up. I won't grade. So tell us a little bit about ear infections. I know there's a lot of parents that have questions about, do I need antibiotics for my kids? Do I not? Should I bring them in? This is their sixth one.
Right.
What's your kind of guideline with ear infections?
So the recommendations by the AAP are, if you have a suspected ear infection in an infant 6 months or old, we treat it. Between 6 and 2 years, if they have a known ear infection, like you can diagnose it, then we do treat with antibiotics. Mm-hmm. And then 2 years and older, we like to wait unless they have a fever and the ear pain is so outrageous. We do like to wait 48 to 72 hours. And the reason for those differences has to do with the anatomy of the ear. So as they get older, the eustachian tubes become less horizontal and more vertical, and so they're able to drain. So if you don't treat the ear infections and they have they have ear infection after ear infection. Before 2 years of age, it can impair their hearing. So that's why we like to treat it. But sometimes ear infections just go away on its own, too.
Right.
Yeah.
What about the, you know, in medicine, it's the serous otitis, but it's often after an ear infection. It's just that fluid that remains. And I know lots of kids have it where they'll say, like, it just feels like there's fullness in the ear.
So they... that can take up to 2 months to go away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you let it just resolve on its own.
Just let it resolve on its own.
Yep.
If it doesn't resolve, sometimes those kids will need ear tubes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like to have parents do some heat and some massage on the eustachian tube and
really
try to get it to drain.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. Well, those tubes are so dang tiny.
They are tiny. You're right. It's, yes. Yeah. manual manipulation.
It is. Yes. And I show kids or I show parents often the picture and I'm like, this is why. Like, look at how tiny this little eustachian tube is.
Yeah. I'll have to add that to my
practice. Exactly. And how about, what's your take on fevers? I have a lot of parents ask about, you know, do you lower a fever? Do you keep a fever going?
Yeah. That's a great question. I'm glad you're bringing it up.
Yeah.
Because it's probably one of the most frequently reason I get called. The only time I worry about an actual number and fever in a healthy individual, one that does not have like a neurological impairment, would under the age of 2 months. So if it's under the age of 2 months, that's the only time we worry about fever. After that, you can call me in the middle of the night and you can give me any number, but I'm going to be like, okay. So studies are showing that if you let a fever run its course, then it can actually shorten the duration of a virus by treating with Tylenol and Motrin, and Motrin should only be used after 6 months of age. You can actually increase the length of that virus because your body is no longer producing all the cytokines and wonderful anti-inflammatory. It's not creating that inflammatory response. So it's not fighting the infection appropriately. So I say let the fever run its course. Obviously, if they're miserable, you can treat with Tylenol. But I really think you should just let it run its course.
Yeah. And it's the body's way of heating it up to burn it out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
And really, the worst that'll happen is a seizure, a febrile seizure, right. Which is not damaging.
It's not
going to mean they have a seizure disorder.
Exactly.
It just means the body goes a little haywire.
It's very, very scary for a family when their child has a seizure. But they're showing that it's actually not the fever. It's the underlying inflammation that's causing that fever, the seizure. They typically run in families. So if it runs in your family, then, you know, just be prepared that might happen with
right.
your child.
And I always tell parents to, if it gets to the point where they're extremely uncomfortable, you can put them in like a tepid bath if you need to.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
it's really up to the parents'
that's
level
right.
of
that's
comfort,
for,
not.
That's treating the parent.
That's treating
sure.
the parent, exactly. Maybe you should just put the parent in the hot bath.
Yeah, exactly.
In a bubble bath.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, in the guidelines about fevers, like whether or not the children can go to school with a fever, do you guys at your office, do you have kind of recommendations about when to keep the kids at home and when you can send them to school?
I feel like, you know, when the body has a fever, it's fighting something, I think you should go home and rest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think you should give your body the opportunity to do what it needs to do. And if you're at school, and I don't think a kid can, if you're not feeling well, you can't be fully present.
No, you can't concentrate at all.
Yeah, so stay home.
What is your thought about vitamin D? Do you test it in kids and do you see it being low?
Yeah, sometimes we do, yes, especially in this area.
Yeah.
You know, it's the miracle thing, it seems like.
Right.
We do recommend nursing mothers to take about 6,000 international units of that a day if they're nursing and the infant is not taking any vitamins. But I think vitamin D is a nice, healthy thing to do. I know for myself, I've taken it in the winter and I've noticed a difference.
Yeah. And I know in the adult population, our lab that we used changed about 6 or 7 years ago. They finally said, everyone is deficient in the Northwest. And so they changed their reference range because it really is that people, and it has a lot to do with where you grew up and not so much where you're located now, which is kind of interesting.
I know when we were in California, there was so much sun there, we didn't even talk about vitamin D.
Right. Well, and I think about it
a
lot with the kids because of bone health. Like you need vitamin D to be able to absorb calcium and phosphorus for the bones.
Right.
And then the immune health.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
And your recommendation, the moms taking it, that's total, including a prenatal. They might be taking that already has
the
vitamin D.
The prenatals typically have about 400 international units.
Right, which is kind of negligible.
Yeah, exactly. So about 4,000 to 6,000. I've heard two different numbers, so I tend to go on the higher one.
Yeah. Well, they're not going to overdose
at
those rates. What about, let's talk a little bit in the remaining time about anxiety in kids.
Mm-hmm.
What are you seeing and what are you finding to be helpful and kind of what's your approach? I know this is really a ongoing kind of increasing thing.
It's surprising to me the amount of anxiety that kids have these days. And I wonder how much of it is having to be with not feeling part of a community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think when we don't feel that we are part of a group, then we start feeling isolated. That can lead to depression, anxiety. And, you know, I think medication can be helpful, but that should not be the first place that we go to. I really do feel like the things that can help are the hardest things, you know.
Yeah.
I think meditation, deep breathing, yoga, these are all being found to be helpful in ADHD, depression, and anxiety. And I think we need to really focus more on that because it is, when you are involved with that, it teaches you skills that you can use for the rest of your life.
Yeah, this is true. I had a guest on the radio show and we were talking about anxiety in adults. And he was saying that if you basically do a repetitive task that's already learned, you already know this task. So, for example, riding a bike or for an adult knitting or even for kids like learning crochet or something that's just an already known repetitive behavior, that actually will shift you from the sympathetic kind of stress response to a more parasympathetic, calm, you know, so especially for a child who I know some of the kids that are more on the ADHD side, for them to sit still and meditate is extremely difficult.
Exactly.
But something, if they're using their body or moving it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
That's a great, I mean, you hear about knitting being so calming.
Right.
Yeah. So it's the opposite for me, but yeah.
It makes you frustrated.
Yeah. I'm like, I want to finish with this project already, but.
So we need to create maybe social, like you said, let's get them not isolated. They need knitting circles.
They do. Actually, I do think, I think that's the direction we need to go to. And the social, you know, the social networking sites, I feel that it gives people a false sense of community.
I think you're right.
And so, you know, kids are involved. And then all the bullying that goes on and along with that. So I agree. Let's start some knitting circles.
Right. And maybe as I was going to ask you this, but kind of what can we do as parents, as caretakers? That's maybe the single most important thing for kids. And obviously it's, you know, give love and yes. give respect and, you know, but it's also maybe that we set limits on electronics and maybe we push the envelope to really make sure that the kids are right. feeling part of something bigger. Or,
yeah.
What in your opinion? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think all of those and setting boundaries for kids, healthy boundaries so kids learn. I find nowadays a lot of people are having a hard time with boundaries. A lot of kids have.
Yeah.
And so I think teaching kids appropriate boundaries. And also going back to that, you know, maybe getting with a group of people in your neighborhood where you, you know, all the kids have a place to go after school. You know, if you have a working mom, you know, like a mini community center or something.
I always laugh when my kids all say, okay, we're going to go walk downtown or walk to the park. And they'll, no, we don't want to. And it's like the moment we walk out of the house, everything changes. But yes. I have to be willing to be the bad
yes.
guy.
Yes.
And in that moment, they hate me for yes. it. But then it's, you know.
Right. Well, you are the parent. You're not their friend.
Right.
You know, you're not right. their friend. You are the one who you're trying to set them up for success in life. And you're trying to teach them things so that when they are finally out on their own, you know, they can navigate this world in a successful
manner. And then we also put aside money for therapy later because they'll inevitably need that for how we messed up.
Well, I was going to say, your kid will have an issue with some area of parenting
right.
that well, you've done.
I always have to remind myself, you know, on a much deeper level, our kids, their souls chose us and we
yes,
chose them and
exactly.
they chose us for our imperfection as much as our perfection.
That's
you
true.
Know, they needed our flaws in a way to grow because
yes.
we can't
and
hold ourselves
to
be perfect.
To
exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, thank you so
thank
much.
You so
and
much.
Thank you so much for your work in our community
oh,
and we're going to miss
Allie.
You.
Oh, thank you so
yeah.
much.
Yeah. You've been listening to Light on Health with my guest, Dr. Jennifer McCall. Thank you to a very generous thank you to our engineer, Kate Brister. And our next show will be October 25th. We will be talking about soul work at the end of life and death work, which should be really interesting. I hope you join us. It's my hope that we've enlightened and empowered you to take one tiny step forward towards your own radiant health. Have a great week. Je m'en fous d'un œil, Lola